This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
In the context of storytelling, when people tell a story, they're trying to get at the truth. And the thing that allows them to get at the truth the deepest is if they're as merciful as possible.
This week on Sea Change Radio, the second half of our discussion with author Steve Almond. In this episode, we delve further into how to navigate the choppy seas in a new age of political uncertainty and social unrest, and chat about a couple of areas of pop culture near and dear to Almond, namely candy and rock music. Then we hear a bit from our 2012 conversation with Steve Almond, where he talks about the right wing's predilection for magical thinking. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Steve Almond. Steve is an author, and his latest novel is All the Secrets of the World. Steve, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Yeah, it's good to be with you, man.
So, Steve, in terms of self-care during this dark time, how do you find writing to be therapeutic in the face of all of this? There's been some amazing art that's been created through some of our darkest periods in the 20th century. I'm a musician and I go out and I play music and I tend not to think too much about the world when I'm doing that. But writing, it's hard not to. You know, everything I read, it brings me back to these parallels of the modern world, and it's upsetting. As an artist, how do you find that balance?
Yeah, I mean, I'm way up on my soapbox because you got me wound up talking about this stuff. And, you know, you're asking good and logical questions. And a certain amount of my response, I go into my, like, we are crazy. Don't you see what's happening? You know,
get out your window and say, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore.
That's it. I don't think that's a healthy place to live. It's somehow having a balance between the things that nourish you and the relationships around you. You were talking before about community. And I think a lot of what people need to do is take care of their relationships and think about their community and think about their friendships and think about their family bonds and try to strengthen those. Those are actually the reason that you want to be somebody who's good and useful in the world, because it does benefit to people who you're in community with. And I think that's a great thing for people to do however they can do. You can't live in a state of constant volcanic rage and you know, sort of sanctimony, and it's just not healthy for people. It's also, I think, important to say, okay, but I don't want to be one of the Americans in this particular era who didn't in some way stand up and register how I feel and to use whatever power is at my disposal as a citizen of a country that still remains free for the most part, to, you know, make my voice heard. It's that balance of saying, I want to take action. I don't want to just sit in anxiety. So rather than just being in anxiety, let me think about the ways in which I can convert that anxiety into action. And that might be attending a rally. It might be writing a letter to the editor. It might be, taking part in some kind of local government function or a faith community. And it might also be making art in some way, making music, or, you know, writing a story that imagines a way to be in the world that didn't exist until you wrote it. I think all that stuff is to the good, because it can be, I think the idea of a kind of a regime like this is to make people feel hopeless and despondent and to have them give up. And it is an important form of resistance to say, nope, I have a lot of people that I love. I love this country, and I don't want to give up. I want to make it better. I don't have to make it great again, but I want to make it better and more empathic and more caring than it is. And I can do that. I can do that through creating art. I can do that through being in community. I can do that through activism and artivism. And there are all these ways that I can take action rather than just stewing in my angry, aggrieved feelings. We've got enough of that.
Yes, and giving joy and entertainment in a positive way. If somebody who's listening to our conversation who hasn't read your stuff may think Steve's a political analyst and he just wrote a novel, but no, you've written books on candy and football, and you are a longtime music critic. If you look at your body of work, it's obviously not one of navel gazing. You're trying to give back. And I think, though, that we're in this age of narcissism. I think there's some embracing of it. Something that I read recently said that in like 1935, Americans were surveyed and 2 out of 10 said they were very important people. But in 2023, I think 6 out of 10 Americans said they felt that they were very important.
Wow.
You know, so we have this age of self-importance, but we've obviously progressed over the years in terms of civil rights and science and just amazing leaps forward as people over the last 100 years. But this new big step backwards feels maybe so especially terrible because of the progress, I think. That's where it hurts, you know?
I think that's right.
I don't know if there's a question there as much as a lament.
No, that's all right. Yeah, well, that's appropriate. It's hard to not try to fix the problem. It's hard for people not to say, well, how are we going to fix it? And part of it is that you have to sit in it and say, this is sad. I don't want to be in this civic culture. Part of what makes me so just upset and bummed out is like, my kids have been living through, I've got an 18-year-old, a 16-year-old, an 11-year-old, and their lives have been dominated by political figures who are just so negative. There's no joy. There's no sense of optimism. Or if there's optimism, it's a kind of sadistic, we'll get rid of the, we'll beat the, we'll vanquish the.
Yeah, your 18-year-old doesn't really remember Barack Obama being president that well, I imagine.
No. And even before that, you know, the idealism of the 60s and the civil rights movement, and before that, the labor movement and the New Deal and the Great Society and the war on poverty. You know, these are things, and before that, abolition and suffrage, you know, and before that, throwing off the tyranny of a king and imperialism. Like, America is actually a story of moral progress, and there is a regression, and there are people who are unsettled by you know, changes and what, for whatever reason, resist it. But there is this larger sense that there is moral progress and that it's difficult. And it doesn't happen because one person stands up on a bus. It happens because a whole bunch of people decide that they want to have a more hopeful and empathic culture. And I don't know when that's going to happen, but God, I feel like I'm so sick of the kind of cruelty and negativity. And it infects us. It's infected our conversation. You know, I would love to go back to having political leaders who are basically running a very complicated government and trying to make good, sensible decisions on behalf of the neediest of their constituents, and to just be able to, for us to just have a conversation about music or sports and not have this kind of dark sword of Damocles hanging over our heads. It just feels awful. And I hope that we get tired enough of it, enough of us, that we find a different way to be a country that's more compassionate and less sadistic and bent on conflict and projecting all of this negative stuff inside of us onto other people rather than trying to work it out.
Yes, just after I asked that question about finding balance, you don't have to be an artist to find that balance. Everybody is doing that dance right now in terms of compartmentalization versus activism. We all want to go out to a rally, but we also don't want to be bummed out constantly and thinking about these things. So we have to find that balance that allows us to be productive members of our communities.
And I think people actually like being at rallies. There's a feeling of being a part of a community. That's why you have to look at what people get out of Trumpism. And those rallies are, for those people, a place where they belong and they feel good. And the idea is not to dump on, you know, whatever they get out of it, whatever joy and sense of belonging, but to ask ourselves, what's our sense of joy and belonging? And, you know, can we find a way to unite around our set of beliefs, our idealism, what I would call the burden of hope? In this new book, Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, I'm basically saying, look, you're going to travel as far into the truth as a storyteller or a musician or a political figure. You're going to travel as far into the truth as your mercy will get you. You've got to try to understand without judgment, to try to understand why and how people's love and their positive good impulses get distorted into destructive action. And I think that's the best posture to take about all of this, is to the extent that you can, say, okay, people by and large are good and they're trying to keep safe and protect themselves and protect the people around them. And that's something we all have in common. And in, I need to see the importance of civic action in my life as my effort to keep my people safe and to find my form of community. And these people over here find it in this way. I don't want to get into a fight with them. It takes too much of my energy. I want to figure out what I believe in and where my community is, and I want to make it larger and more loving and more inclusive. And that's my work.
You know I've always been a dreamer. So hard to change.
Can't seem to settle down.
But the dreams I've seen lately keep turning out and burning out and turning out the same. So put me on a highway and show me a sign and take it to the limit one more time. You can spend all your time making money.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to author Steve Almond. So, Steve, did you come up with truth is the arrow, mercy is the bow? Is that a quote from somewhere else?
No, that's a quote from me.
Yeah, so explain what that means to you. And it's kind of counterintuitive in that we think of mercy being the message that is thrust upon people, but you're kind of reversing it, where mercy is the template, or it's the substrate from which truth can emerge. Is that a fair characterization?
The way I would say it is, in the context of storytelling, when people tell a story, they're trying to get at the truth. And the thing that allows them to get at the truth the deepest is if they're as merciful as possible. So that rather than saying, my dad was abusive and he was terrible to me and he hurt me terribly and I was happy the day he died. That's true. That is what you're feeling, but it's not the deepest truth. The deepest truth is that somehow your dad disappointed you. He had pain in his life, probably put on him by his parents. And he put that pain on you. And it was a terrible loss for both of you. It was awful what happened in those painful rooms. And he should have behaved better. And I'm sure he went to the grave wishing that he'd behaved better. But he couldn't. And now you have to live with that. That's the truth. And you only get to that through mercy, through trying to understand people, not judge them, not condemn them, trying to understand them. Doesn't mean you absolve them of the destructive things they did. I don't think it's okay that millionaires with way more money than they would ever need are making decisions about the fate of people who are barely surviving above the poverty level in this country. I think that's horrible. I think Christ would have kicked over that money changer's table 10 different times. I think that's the message of the New Testament, that we should be ministering to the poor and the iniquitous and those who are suffering, and to the immigrant. I think that's like truly the gospel of love as a revolutionary force. And I think people who act against that, you know, should be opposed actively. But I see their inability to be more compassionate as something that arises from pain and something that arises from their inability to connect to their human compassion for people. It's like their moral imagination has kind of dried up and deracinated and been allowed to go fallow, or it's only reserved for people who are like them and are in their cohort, and it can't extend to people who might be suffering in very real ways. And, you know, you see this all the time when you see some public official talking about an illegal alien or a murderer or rapist, and you're like, you don't know these people. Think about if you had to walk in their shoes. Think about if you had to leave your home down in Honduras because you felt unsafe or you were starving to death and your kids were too, and you had to walk get yourself to the southern border. Like, really think about putting yourself in that person's shoes.
We think of drug addiction, we've put that into just like, well, they're drug addicts. Well, I'm sure they don't want to be drug addicts. I don't think they want to be stealing from their parents to try to not get sick. but something drove them to that precipice and they went over it. And are we going to just throw them away, or are we going to try to care for them so that they can be part of us because they're humans?
That's it. And that's, you know, that's the whole ball game. Truth is the arrow and mercy is the bow. You want to travel deeply into the truth of what somebody is, you know, of the true story of addiction or the true story of immigration or the true story of your own family. You're going to have to bring along mercy, because that's what gets you the deepest into the truth. People aren't born going, wah, wah, I want to hurt somebody. You know, pain is put on them and their love gets distorted into destructive action. That's just the way it works.
Well, let's put a bow on this with some sugar. So you wrote a book called Candy Freaks. And I remember in the book, you described yourself as an author who's had a piece of candy at least once a day for his entire life or something like that. So that was many years ago. Get us up to speed on the candy scene. I know it's changed quite a bit from the era of Zagnuts and Zero Bars.
I mean, all I'll say about that is that I'm now officially lactose intolerant, so I have to be very careful in what I allow myself to eat. So I've gone full dark chocolate. I'm very into the dark chocolate Kit Kat. I'm very into the dark chocolate Reese's Peanut Butter Cup. But that's medical necessity as much as anything else. And like maybe some of your other listeners, I also just have to keep myself from eating too much. I find as I get older, I am not getting any less hungry, and I'm certainly not getting any thinner. So that's where I land.
One other question about music. In Rock and Roll Will Save Your Life, you have a great list that I would like to steer listeners to on best cover songs of all time. It's a great list. I've used a lot of those songs for the music here on Sea Change Radio over the years. And one of the things that you point to is what makes a great cover song is it's completely original. It's not an imitation of something. As a gigging artist, I can't help but see who's getting the biggest slots in a lot of clubs around the country, and it's tribute bands are more popular than we've ever seen before. They're selling out consistently in nightclubs and sometimes arenas, like these bands that do it perfect covers. In the face of lots of great new covers coming out in the Steve Almond mold, there's still this pull to replicate something. Have you seen any of these tribute bands, and how do they make you feel? I'd be curious.
I have not seen a tribute band. I went to see the only concert I've seen in the last couple of years, because we've got kids and things have been crazy and busy, was I went and saw Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, who I'd never seen before, and that was like a religious experience. But, you know, look, what I find is interesting is my kids know classic rock. And, you know, there's a part of me that's like, oh, my God, they got you, you know. But on the other hand, you know,
there's
great Led Zeppelin songs, you know. There's great Eagles songs. There's great songs by Supertramp, you know, all this stuff that I'm vaguely ashamed of. And also, if the songs come on, I find myself going, yeah, all right, this sounds great. So I think music's one of those things where it gives people joy. And I've worked really hard to get out of any place of judgment about what's good, bad. You know, somebody gets joy out of a tribute band, go for it. I love it. So my kids get, you know, joy out of Seals and Croft or whatever I might have never been caught dead listening to, you know, 30 years ago. It's like, great. They're getting a little bit of joy. They get some joy in this world. That's a win.
Steve Almond, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Couple women around. All that ever got me was down. Yeah, there were those who made me feel real good, but never good as I feel right now. Baby, you're the only one who's ever known how to make me want to live away
Now let's hear a little snippet from our 2012 conversation with Steve Almond.
We were talking about the right wing's science denial, and I can't help but link that magical thinking in some ways to what we cover here on Sea Change Radio on a weekly basis. We've profiled an IBM engineering team that's coming up with biodegradable plastics made from plant materials. We just had a guy on this week who he and his team from Caltech have created a new toilet, which not something you would necessarily consider revolutionary, but the modern toilet has been around since the 16th century, and there's over 2.5 billion people who suffer from not getting adequate clean water. Having a good toilet is a great way to go about these kind of things. So the denying of reality and science leads to people also in kind of denying that there are important innovations to be made. And somebody who wants to deny science and that climate change is real may also be totally on board with biodegradable plastics and toilet innovations. But in the same breath, they want to defund education, defund the EPA, defund grants for these type of innovations. Like this toilet was through the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's grant and prize. I guess the question is, what's your greatest hope for reality-based thinking, Steve?
If there is hope, it's like, okay, well, kids and teenagers need to recognize certain precepts. Like they've grown up in an era, for 40 years ago, people had a vague sense, return to the land, so on and so forth. Their cities are full of smog. But we didn't really have the data to say, actually, that's going to kill us. That's going to kill the planet. That's killing our habitat. That's killing our wildlife. That's happening. That's killing our clean water and our sources of food that aren't diseased and poisoned. So now that's become, at least that scientific data exists. There is a counter industry, and I'll say industry because that's what it is, that is fully devoted because they have money at stake, billions of dollars at stake, to the short-sighted thinking that their profits are, it's important enough to their profits that they're going to try to obscure this science. But that science exists, and responsible leaders and politicians and clergy and all the rest of the people who are going to behave like adults have a responsibility to try to make sure that the dominant narrative is we're really going to die as a species. We will annihilate ourselves as a species unless we straighten up and fly right and take care of the planet, period. And hopefully, I mean, the hope that I have is that kids who are raised with that kind of consciousness just make it a priority and they shift the terms of reality rather than saying, well, let's increase the fuel efficiency by 5 miles per gallon and hope that Detroit doesn't go under. They just say, actually, here's the deal. Let's put a gasoline tax of $2 on every gallon of gas to make it so that people are forced to find different solutions, economically forced to find different solutions. And anybody who wants a luxury car that is less than 50 miles per gallon, if you want to be a big man and drive around in your big tank, then you're going to pay a huge luxury tax. That should be treated like the kind of obscene luxury that it truly is. And I further hope that people who are in positions of leadership shift the terms of the debate. So we're not talking about, well, gee, how can we create a more efficient, plastic bag, to say, how do we get rid of the need for that in the first place by creating a local economy and creating, your own land and communal gardens as a place where we get our food in the way that people have been doing it for thousands of years, directly from the source, rather than having to run it through a corporation. I mean, it is difficult to say this to people without them going, oh, you're such a hippie. But it's like, you know what, dude? Like, people have been quote-unquote hippies in the sense that they farm their land for about, 99/100 of human history. The cult of the corporation and the supermarket and all this crap we've gotten used to and the superhighway, that stuff is in its infancy. And even as a little tiny infant, it is managing to kill the planet. We have to completely shift the terms of the debate and the discussion. And people like Obama are responsible for that. I'm glad that he saved, quote unquote, Detroit. But if he really wants to save Detroit, if he really wants to do that, he needs to require that the fuel efficiency of those vehicles goes up to 100 miles per gallon and that half of their fleet is something that runs on sustainable fuels that can be created from sustainable energy. You don't think that's going to stimulate the growth of people who are trying to convert algae into, you know, clean diesel or wind power or electric? I mean, there are ways to do this, and you incentivize it in capitalism, in late model capitalism, by making it worth money. And you have to de-incentivize other kinds of wasteful behavior that isn't actually necessary behavior. It's just convenient behavior. And I think that's the role of government and activists on the left to do that. People who see the problems have to start thinking in more radical ways about how you change the discussion from, oh my God, those climate deniers, like, screw that. Don't even listen to them. They're not a part of the discussion. They're part of a crazy corporate cult. The discussion amongst adults should be, all right, listen, we got environmental ruin coming down the pike in 10 different rubrics. How do we solve those problems? You put the best minds to work on that. You know, the healthcare system is really broken. Every time I read a piece by Atul Gawande, I say, boy, that guy really recognizes the ways in which our healthcare system is broken. Why don't we get him and a bunch of other like-minded, intelligent adults thinking about how the system needs to be refined and give them actual power to do that? That's how the Enlightenment was created. A bunch of smart people who were tired of there being wide-scale abuses of people's inalienable rights said, actually, there's a better way to go about the project of human life. And here are the principles that are set out. That enlightenment happened 400 years ago, or I should say it happened, you know, 300 and some odd years ago. We're still having to sort of battle against a mindset, whether it's environmentalism or other sorts of dangers, that feel to me incredibly childish and primitive. I'm like, I don't want to discuss with you because you're invested in your own infantile omnipotence whether climate change exists or not. It does, and here's what smart adult people say we have to do about it. And here's what I want to hear politicians talking about, not, you know, this side says this. There's no sides. There's science, and there's people who are engaged in a kind of cultism. I'm not interested in them being a part of the discussion. They can go ahead and secede from the United States of rationality.
Author Steve Almond, his latest book is a collection of stories called God Bless America. Steve, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Alex, it was a pleasure to be on Sea Change.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Herbie Mann, Etta James, and Marcus King.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.